Hello, this is the Public Utilities Commission meeting. Before we call the meeting to order, we're going to check the phone lines just to verify who we've got with us at this time. First off, Pat Maroney, I believe you're on with Sprint.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Tom Welk?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Mr. Welk. Clean Siebold?
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
And Jason Topp?
Yes, I'm here, Mr.
Great. Is Mark Bring?
Yes.
Kathy Morrow.
Okay, is joining the meeting.
What about Dean Pawlowski?
Yes, I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Dean. Doug Idol.
Present.
Do we have others on the phone lines?
For Ottertail, we also have Terry Grumman, a manager of environmental service, and Mark Rolfus, Big Stone 2 project manager.
I think I've heard of those guys before.
I'm guessing you have.
Good, thanks. Anybody else on the phone line?
This is Kathy Morrow, project manager for Sprint.
Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we will call the meeting to order. This is Tuesday, January 2nd, 2007, at approximately 1:30. We're here in the State Capitol Building, room 468 in Pierce, South Dakota. This is the time and the place for the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission meeting. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson. Joining me here in Pierce are Commissioner Gary Hansen and Commissioner Steve Kolbeck. We have an agenda for this commission meeting as well as an addendum. And we will start with a couple of announcements. First off, I don't believe that we have welcomed at an official meeting yet Brian Rounds to the commission. Brian started work a couple of weeks ago, and he'll be doing some analyst duties for us, so welcome aboard, Brian. And secondly, we have had some concerns and complaints in recent weeks about how poorly folks that are calling in are turning up, how they're coming across on the web and then also with our archive. And so if you could do your best, if you're on the phone, please take it off speakerphone when you're talking. And then secondly, do your best to speak as loudly and clearly as possible, because I do think that that will aid future generations and their growing interest in the matters of the Public Utilities Commission. So with that, we will turn to our first agenda item, which is Consumer Reports, item number one, and that is a status report on the consumer utility inquiries and complaints received by the commission. Ms. Gregg.
Thanks, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 64 contacts since the last report was prepared for the December 19, 2006 Commission meeting. 12 of the contacts involved telecommunications, 12 of the contacts involved electrical services, 3 contacts involved natural gas service, 9 contacts involved cellular phone service, 20 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 8 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. And 2,121 of the 2,462 complaints received in 2006 have been resolved.
Thanks very much. Are there any questions or comments for Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, we'll move on to the next item of business, which is complaints. Item number one is in the matter of the complaints filed against Dish Network regarding a do-not-call complaint in docket CT06001 and CT06007, and those are complaints filed by James B. Terwilliger and a complaint filed by Pam Lutter. The question today is, shall the commission dismiss the complaints and close the above-listed dockets? This time we'll look to Ms. Gregg or Ms. Van Bakkern.
This is Kara Van Bakkern for staff. These are the last two of the group of individual complaints that we received regarding the Do Not Call complaints regarding Dish Network. All of the individual complaints have been rolled into a staff action that will be in front of the commissioners. As I indicated at our last meeting, Ms. Gregg has gone to great lengths to organize all of these individual files, and they all will receive updates and be aware of what's happening in the larger action, and staff will proceed with the burden to present a case rather than requiring all these individuals travel to Pierre for a hearing. So staff would request that all of these final remaining individual complaints be dismissed and those dockets closed at this time.
Thanks, Ms. Van Bakkern. I presume that neither of the individuals are on the telephone line nor here in Pierre. That being the case, we would open up to any questions or comments that commissioners or advisors would have. Hearing none, perhaps a motion would be appropriate.
A motion in the matter of CT0601 and CT0607 that the commission dismiss the complaints and close the above listed dockets.
Second.
I concur. Motion is made and carries. I wonder, Mr. Welk, would it be a burden to you or the company to push item EL06-002 to the end of the agenda?
Mr. Chairman, this is Tom Welk. I don't mind that. I have a 2:30 deposition that is in my office, and depending on the length, I certainly don't have any objection, but I do have that commitment.
Given that, why don't we go ahead and proceed? I'll apologize to other folks on the agenda that their items may only take a few moments, but let's get started, Mr. Welk, just because who knows how long this will take. So with that, we'll take up under the electric item number one, EL06-002. That's in the matter of the application by Ottertail Power Company on behalf of 7 regional utilities for a permit to construct 5.45 miles of 230 kV transmission line, 33 miles of 345 kV transmission line, the Big Stone 345 kV substation, and modification of the Big Stone 230 kV substation. And the question is today, shall the Commission approve the stipulation, and shall the Commission approve the construction permit? I will note that I believe that there will be a PowerPoint presentation for those of you listening in on the Internet. That presentation can be accessed on the Commission's website. With that, I will turn it over to Mr. Welk or whoever else is appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Tom Welk, and I want to thank the Chairman and the Commissioners and the Commission staff for the many courtesies that were extended to the project and its officials throughout the process of this application and stipulation. This ends up today being a stipulation with the staff regarding the matters relating to the permit, and I'm going to turn the rest of the presentation over to Dean Pawlowski, who has been the project person on this portion of the permit. This is the transmission portion, who is intimately familiar with that. He has sent earlier today a PowerPoint presentation. This is intended to be a very short presentation, but intended to give the commissioners a high-level look of what the facts are regarding this application for permit and some of the stipulations that have been negotiated with the staff regarding the issuance of the permit. So, Dean, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Welk, and thank you, Chairman, for this opportunity today. As Mr. Welk mentioned, I did send out a short presentation, and basically the agenda for that is to review the project for you, review the project development process we went through, the timeline for the project, the stipulations that we've come to conclusion on, and then the final conclusion. And the Big Stone Transmission Project is a project that has 7 co-owners involved in it, with Ottertail Power, based out of Minnesota, taking the project lead. We also have Missouri River Energy Services, which is based out of Madison, South Dakota, or I'm sorry, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I apologize. Harlan Consumer Power District, which is based out of Madison, South Dakota. Montana Dakota Utilities, which is based out of Bismarck, North Dakota. Great River Energy, which is based out of Elk River, Minnesota. Southern Minnesota Municipal Power, which is based out of Rochester, Minnesota. And Central Minnesota Power Agency, which is based out of Blue Earth, Minnesota. It's a wide range of owners in this project, with the smallest being 90 megawatts and the largest being a capacity of 2,500. They have IOUs involved, municipals, and generation and transmission companies. So it's a very unique mix of projects. Moving on to the next slide, what we're here for the project is we have 2 alternatives basically for the project. And that is being driven by the Minnesota process and the federal environmental impact statement. Through the Minnesota process, we are interconnecting on the Minnesota side of the border to 2 substations, and their process requires us to have 2 alternatives. The first alternative, which is our preferred route, is to build a brand new line from Big Stone plant to Ortonville, Minnesota, and then we would upgrade the Ortonville to Johnson to Morris line from a 115 kV line to a 230 line. The second alternative would be a brand new line from the Big Stone substation to Wilmer, and this would go right by south of Ortonville. Common to both of these would be a brand new line from the Big Stone substation down to just north of Gary, South Dakota, and then over to Canby. That would be a brand new line constructed for 345 operation, but initially operated at 230. We would then convert the Canby to Granite Falls line from a 115 to a capability of 345, although it operated at 230. And that one, like I said, is common to both alternative 1 and alternative 2. Although there are two alternatives here on the table, the line in South Dakota would be the same. The line from Big Stone to Gary to Canby is common to both, and the line either from Big Stone to Morse or Big Stone to Wilmer would use the same right-of-way in South Dakota because we need to get by just south of Ortonville. Should also note that we have had some hearings in Minnesota in December, and the Minnesota DOC is actually recommending Route 1, the alternative 1. So we are, and that's where our preference also. Moving on, the next slide actually is just a geographic representation for you. You can see that the Big Stone plant is located on the left side, of probably about a third of the way down. The route that we are seeking approval for today is actually down the South Dakota side. And then we have the line that goes over to the Granite Falls area. And the other one that our preferred route is going up to Morse, which is in the top center section of that. So it puts it in a little geographic frame for you. And this project is being driven by an increase in demand. And the next slide actually shows the growing demand, and this was put together by the CapEx Transmission Partners. It shows that basically there's about a 15% increase in energy needs in the region for the utilities, and we are not seeing any change in that need in the future. The following slide then is a study that the CapEx partners have done. They show that there is a need for an additional 8,000 megawatts of new generation to serve 6,300 megawatts of new load forecasted through 2020. And the graph there is actually signifying the area that they have looked at for doing their studies to make this determination. So there is going to be a lot of new needs coming up, and the Big Stone Transmission Project fits very well into that. We have stepped back and looked at the regional transmission plans and have taken those into consideration in siting of these facilities. The process that we went through to come up with these facilities is basically we have performed a significant amount of technical studies. We've started this in February of 2004, and we are just wrapping those up. We actually did receive MAP, or the Mid-Continent Area Power Pool, a design sub-review committee, which is all the transmission planners in the region, did approve this project in November. And we do expect to have a MISO approval in the next month or two on these. However, we are feeling very comfortable with that approval. MISO did testify in favor of this project in our Contested case in Minnesota, and they also do sit on the MAP DRS, or Design Review Subcommittee. So we are not expecting any unexpected events there. Once the technical studies were sufficiently along the way and we've narrowed down our options, we have involved the public in a number of events. We've actually had four rounds of public meeting out in the area. The first one was a very voluntary and it was from the project put on prior to any applications being submitted, in that we went out and asked for input on the general area and where to run lines. We also had a hearing, which is part of the South Dakota process, in Gary in March of 2006. Then we also had two public meetings for the Federal Environmental Impact Statement. One was a scoping meeting and one was a comment meeting. So we have had a significant, we have involved the public in a number of events. Speaking of the Federal Environmental Impact Statement, that has proceeded along the way, and we are doing a significant amount of environmental review on this project. We have not observed any obstacles that cannot be overcome on the project, and it's looking very favorable from that also. We have also went out and had one-on-one contact with each of the landowners, and we of the 38.45 miles in South Dakota, that's 101 parcels in which we have received options for easement on. There are 102 parcels on the project. With this landowner contact, we have made 14 changes to what we had originally proposed that are basically due to landowner concerns. We have taken the input, and so we've made 14 changes there. And we have made one change due to environmental concerns that we have uncovered. The city of Gary has intervened in the process, but on December 20th, they have signed off on the stipulations. We've also been working very diligently with the PUC staff. They have had two data requests, one in that we replied to in May of 06, and the last one was in, I believe it was in November of 06, to address all of their concerns. So we have worked with all parties, we feel, to come up with a good project. The next slide is just a slide I put in to say that we have taken into account other regional needs. And if you'll see this is actually a wind regime map and with the transmission routes overlaid on it. And you can see that the southern line does go south, and it does tie into the well-known Buffalo Ridge area so that we can accommodate additional wind generation in the future when the line goes to 345, even at 230, it will help alleviate some of the congestion in that area. So we have taken a step back, and we have tried to take other regional needs into consideration. The schedule for the project is that our goal is to have the transmission system substantially complete the first of 2012, and we will work on the South Dakota portion of the project first, with construction starting in the fourth quarter of 2008. Then we will go from from Canby to Granite Falls in 09, 010, and finishing up coming back around from Morris to Big Stone in 2010, 2011 time frame. And I've mentioned a few times that we've had our contested case in Minnesota. That has progressed, and that was finished up on December 21st. We are expecting an administrative law judge recommendation in mid to late March for that, and a PUC decision in May of 07. The federal EIS is another permit that we need. We are expecting a decision for that third quarter of 2007. Then we also have the South Dakota route permit that we will need, and that's what we're here to discuss today. Like I mentioned, we do have options on all but one landowner in South Dakota. We will proceed with easements late 07, the first part of 08, to secure them, although all the landowners have pretty much signed, so to give us permission to use their land for the easement. So we're very good about that. A high-level review of the stipulations that we've agreed to that we will receive all of our federal, state, and local permits, and we will comply with all the requirements of the federal environmental impact statement. We will comply with all the findings of facts of this stipulations. We will continue to provide the Public Utilities Commissions with updates on designs and any changes to the routes or conditions that may come about through the final designing of the project. And we will also continue to keep communication with the landowners on the progress of the project. So in conclusion, I guess, we are asking for the approval to build a new 230 line from Big Stone Power Plant to Ortonville, Minnesota, to build a new line from the Big Stone Power Plant to over towards Canby area, just north of Gary, that would be initially operated at 345, later converted to 345 once other regional facilities are in place that would allow that to happen. We feel this has a large benefit to the customers by providing low-cost energy. It also improves the entire regional transmission reliability, and it also increases the transmission system capabilities in the region. And we will be abiding by all the stipulations that are in the agreement. And with that, I will just open it up for any questions that you may have.
If it's all right with you, we might hold questions until we've had an opportunity to hear from staff as well. Is that all right?
That is fine.
Great, thanks. This time we would turn to staff.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. This is Martin Bettman with Commission staff. And first of all, it is staff's recommendation that the Commission approve the stipulation and grant the construction permit subject to the terms and conditions contained therein. However, there are two terms and conditions on which I'd like to comment. The first is the requirement to comply with the final EIS. And here again, the Commission is being asked to approve a permit without having the final EIS before them, and I don't feel totally comfortable with that all the time. I don't expect any surprises in the final EIS that are going to cause any problems, but it's just a maybe more of a personal issue than anything else. The other term and condition is the requirement to file plan and profile sheets. In other recent transmission siting dockets, these sheets have been filed either as part of the application or in response to staff data requests. Having a plan profile sheets may not necessarily change staff's final recommendation on approving a permit, but it does at least increase my comfort level when making a recommendation, and it would allow the commission's follow the commission's long-standing tradition of requiring exact route descriptions. That's all I have.
We do, City of Gary is an intervener. I didn't ask if there's any comments from the City of Gary. Hearing none, I think we can open it up to questions or comments from commissioners or advisors. I'll start with one. Mr. Bettman, could you explain a little bit more about your second area of concern, and perhaps why that's an issue, and why we're not following standard operating procedure in this instance?
It's my many years of experience looking at siting dockets. We've always asked for a defined center line. You know, so many feet left, right, of a quarter section corner or something, a surveyed center line. They did file a map, and it is, you can generally pick out what side of the section line it's on, or quarter section line. Exact location is not there. It's not absolutely necessary for to get an idea of what impacts the line is going to have, but there's just a comfort level, a personal comfort level, when I can say, well, it's exactly 200 feet south of this quarter corner or section corner is where it turns and goes south, and it's 50 feet west of a section line or of a road right away or whatever it might be. I know exactly where it's at then. It's something that we've always done in the past. And in this instance, it's kind of I think it may be a little carryover from the way they do things in Minnesota. Minnesota doesn't require that until a final design is submitted after the permit or is granted, then they file their final design parameters. I don't even think in Minnesota they even tell them what kind of tower or, pole design to use until after the hearing. So, I say it's not absolutely necessary, but it's something we've always done because my understanding of the code has always been we needed a specific route. And to me that means meets and bounds type thing.
And so why in this instance has that not been the case?
I thought we asked for it and they gave us an updated map. The original wasn't that clear. They gave us an updated filing and but it's never been tied. And I think because I'm not sure they know exactly where it's going to be because of landowners' issues that haven't been answered. They know which landowners are going to be affected, but where exactly on that landowner's property may not be exactly known because they just haven't done the final design.
Perhaps we'd turn to Mr. Welk or Mr. Pawlowski to get your take on that.
Well, we do have land options signed with all of the landowners except for one. So we feel we have, you know, the landowner's permission, and we have been out in contact with them to get their approval to use their land. We have visited with them in fairly good detail about where the line will run. We have taken that into consideration. And, you know, we do have options that are being recorded in the appropriate manner to give us the right to do that. And with that, we have specified to some extent where this line would be running. So we read the law to understand that, you know, we wanted to make sure the landowners were all issues were addressed, and we feel we have done that through the landowner option.
Thank you, Mr. Pawlowski. Other questions from commissioners or advisors?
It's my understanding that the easements are all taken care of. Is that correct?
We have one landowner who has not signed our option. And that is a landowner who resides in Minnesota, I guess, and has one parcel south of the plant area that is unsigned at this point in time.
And I guess my other question would be the moves. Were the moves any way affect? You had mentioned that you had moved some of the original transmission siting. Were those moves a disadvantage, advantage, or are they of no effect to the total project?
No major effect at all. I mean, they were just minor route changes, basically moving from one side of the road to another, or probably around one farmhouse that the landowner wanted run a little different way.
Other questions?
This is Gary Hansen. Could you give me an idea? In my limited knowledge of transmission lines, there's a significant difference between a 345 kV and a 230, and you're building a 345 and operating it at a 230. Are you anticipating, are there plans at the present time for construction of additional generation facilities for that line?
For that line, this has been built to 345 capability to help unlock some of the wind in the Buffalo Ridge area. It also fits into the larger regional transmission plan. The difference is not a whole lot between the 230 and the 345 structure. 345 will have a couple feet wider base if it's the H-frame, and probably about 10 feet taller is all. It will have two conductors per phase versus one for a 230, but it's actually being done to help the overall regional transmission system. It will go to 345 once some CapEx facilities are built, specifically a Brookings to the metro region. That'll be built at 345. They are starting that permitting process in Minnesota this year. It actually started it last year. And by doing that, it's going to unlock, you know, a large potential for additional wind. Right now, the Buffalo Ridge area, if you take there's a constraint of there's probably about 6,000 megawatts in the queue for wind generation in that region above beyond Big Stone. And this will help open up that queue a fair amount. So it's being done for the regional transmission. I can't say that it's for a specific generation type because of the MISO queuing process that is involved these days.
Thank you. Wind is, of course, a magic word with our commission, so we appreciate your using that as often as you can. Can you give me an idea of approximately how many megawatts would be on excess capacity potential for that line? Don't worry, we're not going to hold you to it, but
right.
We just...
Well,
curiosity more than anything else.
Yep, the Big Stone transmission facilities and the Brookings to Minneapolis CapEx facilities, together they will open up about 800 to 1,000 extra megawatts of capability.
Great. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep.
I have some other questions, and I'll maybe see, pause to see if anyone else has before I hog it. I would just look to staff to see, I mean, I know we published a notice of this proceeding of the public hearing and newspapers throughout the area. I might just look to staff to see if we've received any public or consumer complaints or concerns about this item. I didn't see any in the record, any letters in the record, so I thought I'd ask.
I had no comment or contacts with any landowners. I think anybody else on staff did either, so pretty well received by public.
No, we haven't had any consumer contacts in the Consumer Affairs Office either.
It's probably worth noting, and I haven't reviewed the transcript, but my recollection of the public meeting that we held in Revilla was that there was not any outcry that I can remember about the project in general. So, Commissioner Kolbeck asked about route changes, and a question for Mr. Pawlowski. Were there landowners that suggested route changes that that the partners, that the applicants, were not able to honor?
Not to my knowledge. I guess I had some other of my land management people do that. I think we've made the route work talking to the landowners, I guess. The only one would probably be the particular person who has not signed the option at this point in time. And that would be the only one that we probably haven't been able to completely accommodate. That would be because of some of the other federal permit issues. We are restricted by the federal AES on where we can run the line within the corridor or underneath their parameters, and it also does run through some the granite area, I believe, that we have a very restricted area in which we can get to without increasing the cost a fair amount to the project.
So is it fair to say that with one exception, to your knowledge, there were not any landowner routing requests that you were not able to honor as part of this process?
That is correct.
Okay, thanks. I notice in one of the stipulations is that a copy of any order the commission might issue in this case, as well as our contact information, would be disseminated to landowners along the route. If somebody could remind me whether or not something like that was done in advance or at an early portion of this proceeding. And I know the notice on the commission's part was in the newspapers, but we didn't mail anything to any landowners, did we? And then I might ask, also for the applicants if, well, we'll wait for Mr. Bettman first. Go ahead.
Staff not aware of any direct mailings to landowners.
Okay. And, obviously, the applicants, you were speaking to landowners along the route. Would there be any chance that a landowner, and I won't say any chance, is there a likelihood that there might be a landowner along the route, obviously not one that would have to get an easement, but that there would be a landowner close to the route who would not have knowledge of this transmission line at this time, Mr. Pawlowski?
We are not envisioning a whole lot of objective. We have sent mailings to people in the corridor and along the route, also through the federal process and through some other mailings. So we are not envisioning, and we already have options, secured on the land.
Well, my concern wasn't those folks in the footprint, so to speak, but those people right next door. For instance, you've got, the transmission line passing within 260 feet of one landowner and of one home and 270 feet of another home. Presumably those folks are landowners that have signed options. They're not adjacent landowners, right?
They are adjacent. They haven't signed, not all of them necessarily have signed options. However, we have been out in the area four times with public meetings trying to get the input for that. Most of the land, we have, in trying to secure the route, we have talked with numerous landowners on both sides of the road trying to get input to make sure it goes where it would be the least obtrusive to the landowners. To try to get everybody's input.
Sure, I know that
reach everybody, but
I know that the noise is not supposed to, you know, exceed normal background levels. Is the noise given off by a transmission line, is that tied to volume at all? I mean, I'm obviously not an electrical engineer, so I mean, if this thing is filled to capacity, is the noise emanating from the line different than if it's only half full?
I cannot answer that one properly. I guess I wouldn't know. I know that it probably would be, there would be slightly more noise coming off it during a hot or a humid day or through rain. Would be the only way that would really increase in volume.
And this would have been a better question for the public hearing, so I'll apologize. I should have given you more of an opportunity to track down these numbers. But, you know, maybe I'll look to the, you know, Mr. Bettman, you know, our staff engineer. I mean, were the noise studies that were done, were those done with the idea that this thing would be plumb full of juice or that it would be done on a hot day? Or what were the presumptions that were put into running these noise analyses?
Without double checking, usually they run them at full, you know, worst case scenarios, full load and, you know, high moisture conditions where you get the you know, static crackle and the noise from that.
Commissioner Hansen mentioned earlier that a magic word for the commission is wind. I would note that another would be noise. Or a little gun shy about noise, so we do want to make sure that those the proper presumptions were taken. Those are the only questions that I've got at this time. We'll see if other commissioners or advisors have questions. Hearing none, do you have any closing comments, Mr. Pawlowski?
No, I do not.
Okay, thanks. A motion would be appropriate at this time, unless any of the advisors have anything else to add. With that, I would move that the commission approve the stipulation, and as a result, that the commission would also approve the construction permit.
Second.
Subject, obviously, to the conditions laid out in the stipulation.
I concur.
Thank you very much. Motion is made and passes. Thanks very much to the applicants. Obviously, it's not every day South Dakota has an opportunity to get a $40 million investment, $40 million worth of $110 million investment anyway. So thanks very much to the applicants. And staff.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners.
With that, we'll move on to electric item number 2, which is EL06-028. That's in the matter of the joint request for an electric service rates exception between Lyon Rural Electric Cooperative Incorporated and Sioux Valley Southwestern Electric Cooperative, doing business as Sioux Valley Energy. Question before the commission is today, first, shall we grant intervention to any parties that have timely filed? I don't think I saw any applicants for intervention. And then secondly, shall the commission grant the service rates exception? At this time, we would look to the parties. Is anyone representing either Sioux Valley Electric or Lyon Rural Electric Cooperative on the line or in person?
No.
All right, then. At this time, we'll look to staff, either Mr. Rounds, Mr. Bettman, or Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. Also, thanks for the welcome. This is Brian Rounds, staff analyst for South Dakota PUC. Sioux Valley Energy and Lyon Rural Electric Co-op filed an agreement for electric service territory exception to the Sioux Valley Energy Service Territory, permitting Lyon Rural Electric Co-op to provide electric services to a new rural service in Track 2, Grimius Edition, in the south half of southwest quarter of Section 35, Township 101 North, Range 48 West, in Minnehaha County, South Dakota. Lyon Rural Electric Co-op is already providing service to Mr. Grimius' new building from the existing service point, and Sioux Valley Energy would need to construct over 2,000 feet of new electrical line to provide service to a new shop. Both Sioux Valley Energy and Lyon Rural Electric Co-op agree that this exception will avoid unnecessary duplication of facilities. Both parties also agree that this exception does not change the service area assigned to Sioux Valley Energy
and that upon removal or abandonment of the service, the agreement will be terminated. The owner of the property, Mr. Earl Grimius, is also in favor of the exception. Staff would agree that this exception is in the public's interest and would recommend that you thereby grant the service rights exception.
Thanks, Mr. Rounds. Was I right in my statement that there, no one had filed for intervention?
I'm not aware of anybody filing. So.
Great. Any questions from commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, a motion would be appropriate?
I motion in the matter of EL06028 that the commission grant the service rights exception.
Second.
I'll concur. Motion carries. We'll do the telecommunications portion of the docket. I might look to the folks on the line from Quest and ask the same question that I asked of Mr. Welk. Would it be possible to move this through the end of the agenda for efficiency's sake?
No problem from Quest perspective.
Thanks, Mr. Todd. Appreciate that. With that, we'll proceed to item number two, which is TC06-192. It's in the matter of the application of Multiline Long Distance Incorporated for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunications services in South Dakota. And the question before the commission is today, shall we grant a certificate of authority to Multiline Long Distance Incorporated? I don't think I saw anybody on the line or in person from Multiline, so we'd look to Mr. Solem or Ms. Van Bakker.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. The applicant intends to provide OnePlus outbound dialing, 800 toll-free inbound dialing, directory assistance, and postpaid calling card services. The applicant has requested a waiver from filing a cash flow statement as required by ARSD 2010-2402-8 and has also agreed to restrictions from offering any prepaid services and from collecting customer deposits or advance payments. The applicant has met the requirements for the granting of a certificate of authority. Therefore, staff recommends the commission grant the waiver request and issue Multiline Long Distance Incorporated an inter-exchange certificate of authority subject to restrictions from offering any prepaid services and from collecting customer deposits or advance payments without prior approval of the commission.
Thanks very much, Mr. Solem. Any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors?
Did I miss it there? This is Commissioner Kobach. Did I miss it? They were requesting a waiver?
No? Yes, they're requesting a waiver from filing a cash flow statement.
And you're okay with that?
We have done that in other dockets.
And excellent question, Commissioner Kobach. That is something that I think is periodically done, particularly for new businesses or businesses that don't have a particularly long track record. And we're a little more comfortable doing that because of the conditions and the restrictions that we put on those folks. Did I say that all right, Mr. Solem?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Always a good answer. Other questions?
Or comments? Any motions?
I will move that in TC06-192 that the commission grant the certificate of authority under the conditions and stipulations as recommended by staff.
I'll second.
I concur.
Next, under telecommunications, is item number three, and that's in the matter of the filing for approval of terms and conditions for interconnection, unbundled network elements, ancillary services, and resale of telecommunications services in dockets TC06-194 and TC06-197. Those deal with Quest and Mid-States Telecom, as well as, and that's in 194, and then between Quest and Crystal Communications, also known as Hickory Tech Long Distance, in -197. Question is, today, shall the commission approve the above-listed agreements? First, we'll look to either of the parties to see if there are any comments by them, and if there are not, then we'll look to Ms. Van Bakker.
This is Tara Van Bakker for staff. The agreements were all properly filed and executed. They do not appear to contain any discriminatory language. No comments were filed, and staff recommends approval.
Thanks very much. Any questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Are there any motions?
I motion in the matter of TC06-194 and TC06-197 that the commission approve the above-listed agreements.
I'll second.
Motion carries. Before taking up item number four, we will move to the addendum to the agenda of the commission meeting. And item number one under telecommunications of the addendum is TC06-186, and that's in the matter of the application of Capital Telephone Company for a certificate of authority to provide local exchange services and exchanges served by Quest. The first question before the commission is today, shall the commission grant a certificate of authority to Capital Telephone Company? I do believe that we have a representative or someone representing a Capital Telephone Company on the line. Mr. Idol, should we look to you first or someone else?
We can look to staff first. We're basically on the line to answer any questions that the commission or staff may have.
Wonderful. Thanks, Mr. Idol. We'll look to staff. Mr. Solem, Ms. Kramer.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem of staff. The applicant has requested a waiver from RSD 2010-3203-22 from filing an income statement and a cash flow statement as required by 2010-3203-11A. The applicant has agreed to restrictions from accepting customer deposits or advance payments and from offering any prepaid services. The applicant has met the requirements for the granting of a certificate of authority. Therefore, staff recommends the commission grant the waiver request and issue Capital Telephone Company Incorporated a certificate of authority subject to the rural safeguards. Also, restrictions from offering any prepaid services and from collecting customer deposits or advance payments without the prior approval of the commission are recommended.
Thank you. Anything to add, Mr. Idol?
Nothing to add.
Okay, thanks very much. Any questions for either staff or the party by commissioners or advisors? Are there any motions? I will move that the commission grant the COA to Capital Telephone Company subject to restrictions and conditions outlined by staff.
Second.
I'll concur.
Motion carries. We'll now proceed to back to the regular agenda, telecom item number four, which is TC06-196. That's in the matter of the filing by Capital Telephone Company for approval of its intrastate switch access tariff and for an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates. The question before the commission is today, shall the commission approve the intrastate switch access tariff? And additionally, shall the commission grant an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates? Again, we will first look to Mr. Solem and Ms. Kramer.
Mr. Chairman, this is Nathan Solem with staff. Capital filed a petition in accordance with ARSD 2010-2711 asking that they be exempt from developing company-specific cost-based intrastate switched access rates. Capital is further asking for waivers of ARSD 2010-2707 and that they not be required to come back before this commission every 3 years. Also 2010-2712 so they can mirror the Quest rate instead of the LECA Plus rate, and 2010-2713 for billing and collection rates. Capital also requested the approval of its access services tariff. Staff supports this petition and is recommending that the commission approve Capital Telephone Company, Inc.'s petition and grant the waiver of ARSD 2010-2707, 2010-2712, and 2010-2713, and allow Capital to adopt the Quest intrastate switched access rate with no time restrictions. We are also recommending approval of Capital's access services tariff and that the commission allow Capital Telephone Company, Inc. to file adjustments to its intrastate switched access rate so long as those adjustments either mirror Quest rate or are lower.
Thanks very much. Mr. Idol, anything to add?
No, again, Mr. Chairman, here to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? I would, look to advisors and perhaps also staff, but do we have everything in the questions before the commission? Do we have everything incorporated in there that we need to have? For instance, is the approval of the interstate switched access tariff, that presumes the waivers of the rules that are listed in our blurb there. Is that correct?
I don't know what I would probably include in the motion reference to the waivers that staff recommended.
And are those listed properly in the description underneath the docket name, specifically 2712, 2707, and 2713?
Yes.
Okay. Other questions or comments by commissioners or advisors?
I guess I just have a question. That seems like a lot of exemptions. It's all covered underneath the quest, though. I mean, are we protecting our consumers here by granting those waivers?
Yes, we are.
Another good answer to always give. But maybe it would be, perhaps you could walk through, because I know as a new commissioner I had similar questions that Commissioner Kolbeck's bringing up. Maybe talk just briefly about each of those rules and why why there are logical reasons for us to waive those and allow somebody to not do an expensive and time-consuming study, but instead to mirror that quest rate. Would that be helpful, Commissioner Kolbeck?
Very. Thank you.
I'm going to defer to Mr. Sanger to answer that.
The way our rules read is it requires, it allows a company to not file a cost study. That's what he meant by the 2010-2711 petition, a company to not file a big lengthy cost study. And in the past, we have allowed CLECs and, in fact, some small ILECs not to do that. Essentially, I don't think this CLEC could even do that because it doesn't have historical cost data to even do that. It's not currently serving, so there's absolutely going to be nothing, no way for it to actually file a cost saving. Even if it did, it's probably not using the telecom chart of accounts. It's probably using GAAP accounting, so it would be very difficult to convert all that to file a complete cost study. So therefore, the rule allows them to file this petition in order to exempt them from filing this, filing a lengthy cost study. And then after they get that exemption, Rule 12, 2010-2712, says that they have to use the average schedule, the average rate of all the telecom companies serving under 100,000. Well, that would be all of our rural ILECs in South Dakota, excluding Quest. And right now that rate, based on the last LECA settlement with staff and the interveners, that is at 12.5 cents. Quest rate is at, I want to say it's either 6.09 or 6.9. I can't remember. I always get it screwed up. So it's in between 6 and 7 cents. This company is going to be serving within Quest service territory, so to staff it makes a lot of sense for this company to actually get an exemption from using a higher rate, and essentially what they're doing is moving their rate down. And the billing and collection, there again, it says that they have to use the billing collection costs of all those companies under 100,000. So this again, and this is something we do very often for CLEC serving. In fact, we've been pushing very hard for CLEC serving in Quest service territories to do this, because really it just doesn't make sense for them to get the LECA plus rate, which was what we refer to as all the average schedule or the companies serving under 100,000. It doesn't make any sense for them to get the Quest rate or the LECA plus rate, and better suits the Quest rate. So this is something we've done often, and we believe it's in the public interest to do so.
Fantastic. Thank you.
This is Greg Russell speaking. There's one other reason for doing this that, to me, maybe makes more sense than most. When a company's in a startup position, they'll expend similar cost as to what Quest would to serve this community. But until they have customers, their minutes of use would be very low. So what you would end up with are similar costs but very few minutes of use. And so when you do your average rate, it's incredibly high. You know, it could end up being, you know, $2, $3, $10 a minute for some of these companies until they're in a steady state business world. So it's just helpful for a period of time to let them get their feet on the ground.
So it actually benefits the customer more than the company?
Yes, in an environment where there's mandated competition. Now, if there was a mandated competition and there was only one company serving, then we could question that under a monopoly rate-making model. But where there's mandated competition, it certainly benefits the customer to do it this way.
Thank you.
Just one other observation, too. In addition to that, it does maintain parity between the incumbent and competitors, and does not then, in effect, subsidize the competition by the competitor by giving them a rate that is way higher than what the incumbent has for performing exactly the same service. This lowers rates. It lowers them by about to less than half of what they would otherwise be. And those are inter-carrier rates, but that still results in a subsidy to a competitor that's allowed to compete in a zone and pay less than half of what the incumbent is paying in that same place. Collecting, I should say, not paying.
Other questions? Did that resolve your question, Commissioner Colbeck?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions or comments by advisors or staff? Hearing none, I would move that the commission approve the interstate switch to access tariff, keeping in mind, and that the commission should grant an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates. And as part of that, the commission would grant a waiver to 2010-2712 so that the Quest rates can be mirrored, as well as a waiver to 2010-2707, waiving the requirement that the company file cost study data every 3 years. And finally, the commission waived 2010-2713 so that the calculation of billing and collection costs would be waived, or rather that particular rule would be waived regarding how those are figured. That's the motion.
Okay. I'll second.
I concur.
That's right. Thanks very much. The motion carries. We'll proceed to telecom item number 5, TC06-198. It's in the matter of the filing by Sancom, which does business as Mitchell Telecom, for approval of revisions to its interstate switched access tariff. And today, first, we'll ask if the commission will grant intervention any parties that have timely filed. I don't believe there have been any. But then, secondly, shall the commission approve the revised interstate switched access tariff? First, we'll pause to see if there have been any petitions for intervention.
There were no interventions filed.
All right, then we will dispose of that question and move instead to the second, which is, shall the commission approve the revised interstate switched access tariff? And do we have anybody with Sancom on the line?
Yes, Doug Edel from Vantage Point representing Sancom.
Would you like to proceed, Mr. Edel?
Basically here to answer any questions again. I think staff has a recommendation.
All right, then we will look to Mr. Best or Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Harlan Best with staff. This company, Sancom, doing business as Mitchell Telecom, was granted the authority to use the LECA Plus rate of 13.25 cents in docket TC04-0204-258, and that rate was subject to refund with interest. With the commission approving the LECA settlement that took care of the cost dockets for 2004, 2005, and 2007, the part of that agreement was that there would be no refunds. So what staff is recommending in this docket for Sancom is that the company, and the company has agreed that they would use the LECA Plus rate, which is 12.25 versus the LECA settlement rate of 12.5, and that this rate would be for the remainder of their 3-year exemption period. So it would run through this year. And that, as I said, it would be no refunds tied to this docket. Staff would recommend approval of a rate of 12.25 cents for Sancom for the remainder of the calendar year.
Thanks very much, Mr. Best. Mr. Adol, anything to add?
No, Mr. Chairman, just that Sancom filed this to be consistent, just like Mr. Best mentioned, with the LECA settlement.
Okay, thank you very much. Any commissioner or advisor comments or questions?
I move that the commission grant the stipulations as recommended by staff and grant the waiver.
I'll second.
Just want to pause for a moment to make sure that we get our...
TCO 6198, I move that the commission grant the intervention to no parties have intervened. That the commission approve the revised interstate switch access tariff. Did I get it right this time?
I'll second.
And I will concur. Motion carries.
Just one second here, Harlan. Did you need anything, Harlan, in there specifically referencing that 12.25, or is that, or did I misunderstand that?
The company has filed tariff sheets implementing the 12 and a quarter.
So the current filing that takes care of it then with that motion.
Right, and it went into effect yesterday.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Good question, Mr. Smith. We'll proceed to telecom item number 6, TC06-200, and that's in the matter of the filing by Sprint Communications Company, LP, for a waiver to obtain a new LRN block in the Lake Preston Rate Center. And the question is, today, shall the commission grant intervention to any parties that have timely filed? I don't believe there have been any. And then secondly, shall the commission grant the waiver? We'll pause it first to see if there have been any petitions for intervention.
No interventions filed.
No petitions for intervention. We'll dispose of that question and proceed to whether or not the commission shall grant the waiver. I do know that we've got some folks from Sprint, Pat Maroney. Kathy, is it Moreau?
Yes.
Okay, great. We've got some folks on the line. Would you like to proceed?
We're basically here today. The commission has questions. It's probably not the most common thing that's happened, but
I think
Mr. Best is probably. I would concede that you should go ahead. And if you
Mr. Maroney, I am sorry. We have almost completely lost you. Breaking up quite a bit. I know you said you were here to answer questions, but then after that, we lost you.
Let me try this way. Is that better?
Much.
Okay, sorry. Yes, we're basically here to answer questions, and I have our project manager is on the line and the code administrator if there is need. So we would defer to that.
Normally we'd look to staff to see if they have something, but and I'll look to staff. If they're planning kind of an explanation of what this request is, then we can go to staff. But if staff isn't planning an explanation, I might ask the parties to expound a little bit on what they're asking the commission to do here. This is not a typical action for the commission. So,
right.
Is staff planning a 101 course for the commissioners, or if not, then I will ask the company to provide that.
Why don't you have the company do that, and we'll see if it agrees with what I would have said.
Well, that is an excellent idea. All right, well, I'm going to toss the hot potato back at you, Mr. Maroney. If you would give us an idea of what you're asking the commission to do here, specifically and why we would need to do this, I think that would be much appreciated.
Okay. I would like to defer to – is Kathy still on the call?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to give the background of this?
Originally, we had the LRN assigned to Vermilion, and because we are – scoping that rate center, we need to go ahead and assign to another rate center, and we have chosen Lake Preston, and we understand that currently the main LRN is Quest. Am I right?
That's my understanding.
Jeff?
Yes.
Okay. And so we are asking for obtaining a second LRN, and as soon as the Vermilion one, as soon as we receive the Lake Preston one, the Vermilion one LRN will be descoped and returned. So we need something, we need to have two of them in the interim.
And due to NAMPA rules, we cannot, we do not have sufficient demand at the moment to get a new LRN. So actually what we are actually asking you to do is to allow us to do an exchange.
Maybe even before looking to staff, I'm going to ask, I did ask for 101. I think you probably gave that to me. I'm going to ask for the remedial course, probably just for me. But terms like descoping, I think I know what that means. I mean, is that pulling out of a market?
It's pulling out of a rate center, yes.
Pulling out of a rate center. So... Could you
currently have a customer on it, and by taking by
no longer having that rate center, that means that the rest of the LATA would not have an LRN to be assigned to.
In other words, there would be no routing for the calls.
Right.
An LRN is a local routing number.
Go ahead, Commissioner Kolbeck.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Kolbeck. I just said, I'm not getting why. I mean, why would you want another NPA NXX to just change over to another NPA NXX and then give the first one back? That doesn't make any sense to me, I guess.
Can I step in here?
Yeah, we can barely hear you, though.
This is Chad Honor. I'm the code admin. And
Chad, I'm going to stop you and ask you to speak up quite a bit louder again. I think I can hear you, that we can hear you here, but I am concerned about folks on the Internet and then our archives.
Okay, how's this? Is it better?
It's a little better. I might even force it a bit more if you can.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Basically, we have a rate center, which is an LRN in LATA 640. We have to return that LRN because we are descoping or removing that rate center from the market. We can't remove it because, there, like Kathy said, there's already a customer assigned to that LRN. So we have to open another LRN before we can get rid of the existing LRN so we can port those numbers to the new LRN. I don't know if that sheds any light on it, but that's why we're needing another LRN before we can remove the old one.
I get that part. My question is still why. Why the new number? What don't you like about the existing number? Why wouldn't you just leave it the way it is?
You mean to use the number for the new rate center?
Yeah, why would you want a new number in a rate center?
The NPA and NXXs for Lake Preston are different than for Vermilion. Am I correct, Chad?
Yes. Actually, Lake Preston has already been returned, and I'm waiting for this today to reorder as an LRN. The only resources we have is for Vermilion, and we have that NPA and NXX.
So you're going to take two NPA and NXXs and make them one. Is that correct?
We only have one right now, and that's Vermilion, and that's the LRN. We need to establish an LRN, another LRN, and then we'll descope the NPA and NXX for Vermilion, and we'll return that to the industry. So actually, we will only still be having one, but temporarily we'll have two.
For about 2 months, we'll have two.
Yes, sir.
I guess I don't know why you would start with one, have two, and then go back to one.
Why is it we have to get rid of this LRN?
That's the whole question.
That's his question, I think. And right, and that would be an answer for, I would think, Kathy. I'm not sure. I mean, basically, I know we're changing markets, so.
We're changing markets because we have sold the responsibility for that other market to someplace else.
You want to use your LRN somewhere else, is that correct? Or I guess you have obligations to a market somewhere else. Where would that be?
It's the same market. It's this cable partner is selling this rate center, so we will no longer have access for an LRN for that rate center.
There you go.
So we have to establish another LRN to take the traffic for the existing LRN. Is that better?
Yeah, that explains it better. This is our competitive local exchange company, and we do a great deal of business with cable companies as kind of their doing their lines and whatnot. And this particular cable company is a particular cable company, I think, has traded territory with someone else. Is
yeah.
that right? And in doing so, we do not have an agreement with this other cable company. And so in order to serve this customer, we're going to have to give back the current number that we have that is being transferred to a different cable partner.
Okay, then how are you going to give that LRN back if you don't own it?
Well, we have it now. We'll give it back to NAMPA. Isn't that right?
Yes, we will.
We'll just return it to NAMPA and the Fully Administrator suggested that we ask the Commission for an exemption so that they could go ahead and do that. They understand what we're doing apparently better than I do.
This is, Commissioner Johnson, this is beginning to make more sense to me. I might just add that, and I don't think we'll see a lot of these in the future, so this is probably, you know, futile, but I did think the one, you know, when I was looking through the, you know, the docket last week, the one pager I didn't feel like, the one page filing didn't really give us a lot to go on, and I think a lot of your explanation today has been helpful, and some of that information might have helped us get our minds around this in advance of the proceeding, so.
Well, thank you. I agree.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask him for pure curiosity, I guess, but also to so I can understand this. For goodness sakes, why Lake Preston, you know, of all places?
It's the only one we haven't returned. We have available in that market. It's the only rate center we have available in that market to switch to an LRN. We know that it's really small and there's not much resources there, but it's our only shot.
You mean it's the only, what, available
rate center in that market for that cable partner, yes.
Especially that we have not completed our build for yet. We have other customers on the same ladder, mm-hmm. But
they're not in that, they're not in that location, right?
Right.
Are these customers in Lake Preston?
They are proposed customers in Lake Preston.
Okay.
This is Commissioner Kovac again. You understand that there's only one LATA in South Dakota?
Yes, sir. 640. I didn't mean LATA. I meant market.
Okay.
I might have said LATA.
If appropriate, maybe at this time we look toward Mr. Best for staff's recommendation.
When the company first filed this, first thing I did was I contacted Newstar, which is the pooling administrator, and asked them what's going on because the commission had never received a request like this before. And their response was, well, aren't you the lucky one? But evidently, this is common practice in other states where they have to exchange local routing numbers due to market conditions changing. So what I asked Newstar to do was send me some information on what they needed to have. And what Newstar said is what the commission should do is this is, since it is a common practice within the industry to change local routing numbers, that this is not out of the ordinary. And the only thing that Newstar would request that the order state and what Sprint has already agreed to do, and that is that the block that they are no longer choosing to use, once all the numbers have been ported from that local routing number, that number gets returned to Newstar.
Absolutely.
And with that, staff would recommend granting the waiver of the request for the new local routing number block in the Lake Preston Exchange with the condition that the Vermilion local routing number block be returned to Newstar once customers have been transferred over.
Thanks very much, Mr. Best. Other commissioner advisor questions or comments? I do notice the letter filed by Sprint does indicate that they'll be donating that block back, and presumably with any, you know, if the commission were to grant the waiver, that's, I mean, their letter is part of the official record, so no additional action beyond granting the waiver is required by this commission, correct?
Newstar would like to see that within the actual order itself.
All right. Okay, so we can make that part of the motion. Unless there are any other questions or comments, does anyone have a motion?
I never claimed to be the smartest knife in the drawer, but I think I get it now. In the matter of TC06-200, under the stipulation that the NPA and XX be voted, reverted back after all numbers are ported, I will move that the commission grants this waiver.
Thank you very much.
I'll second.
Concur. Motion carries.
I'd like to thank Mr. Vest for his help on this matter, too. We got off to a little rocky start trying to write this up, and he was most gracious.
Well, your comments are appreciated not only by Mr. Vest, but also all of us here at the Commission. We think he does good work as well, and it's nice of you to say that. Thank you very much, and thanks for being on the line.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
We'll turn now to telecom item number 7, which is PC06. That is not Jingle Bells. TC06-202, it's in the matter of the filing by INX Communications North Incorporated for approval of its interstate switched access tariff and for an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates. And first off, we will see if any parties have filed for intervention at this time.
No one has filed.
And we'll look past the first question on the agenda and instead look toward the others, which are, today, shall the Commission approve the interstate switched access tariff? And secondly, shall the Commission approve the exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switched access rates? Is anyone from INX online or here in Pierre?
I do not believe so.
Hearing and seeing none, we will turn to Mr. Best or Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Harlan Best of staff. The INX originally received a 3-year exemption from filing cost study within docket TC02040. Upon not receiving any type of information from the company, I sent them a letter and told them that their 3-year exemption order had expired and requested that they file a modification to their request an additional 3-year period, or, as in this case, they agreed to the quest rate to mirror or be less than the quest rate. So what they submitted was the filing that you see before you in TC06202. What staff would recommend is that the commission grant a waiver of the use of the formula that is in ARSB 2010-2712. And 11, and also that they allow the INX to mirror the quest rate or be lower than the quest rate, and at the same time the commission waive the requirement within ARSB 2010-2707, which requires the company to file every 3 years.
Thanks, Mr. Best. Questions or comments by commissioners or advisors? Before one of us makes a motion, I want to make sure this will sound very similar to one that we made earlier, and not only needing to deal with the questions put forth before the commission, but then also explicitly providing waivers for a few of those rules. I heard 2010-2712. I also heard 07 and 11. Okay. Does anyone have a motion?
In TC06-202, I move that the Commission approve the interstate switch access tariff and approve the exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch access rates and grant the waiver of ARSD 2010-2712 and 2710-2707.
Now, how are you able to do that so much more smoothly than I did the first time we did it? I will happily second that.
I'll concur.
Once a year. With that, we'll move to what I believe is the last agenda item today, and that is thanks to the patience exhibited by Quest. We appreciate it very much. And we'll now proceed to telecommunications item number 1. That is TC06-171. That's in the matter of the filing for approval of a Quest Local Services Platform Agreement between Quest Corporation and Granite Telecommunications, LLC. question before the commission is today, shall the request for reconsideration be granted? And we will look first to Quest.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. This is Jason Topp from Quest. I guess just a procedural question, if I might. In Minnesota, I know they ask that they make a decision as to whether to reconsider before I start arguing on the merits. And I'm not sure if you'd like me to give you sort of the background and why we're doing what we're doing here right off the bat, or if there's some step you'd like to go through first.
Good question. I'm going to look toward our general counsel and to get either his or her take on how they think procedurally we should proceed.
Pardon me.
Has somebody woken Mr. Smith? Would you like to me to repeat the question? Or?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Mr. Topp asked if he should be allowed. He said in Minnesota, a motion has to be the commission has to vote to reconsider before an argument can be made based on the merits. He is curious specifically how we want to proceed today. Mr. Topp, what did I mess up in that?
No, I think that's generally accurate, and it's not like I have a treatise here, but I probably do have, you know, 3 or 4 minutes in which I'd like to sort of describe in total what we're doing. So I'm happy to go forward with that, but I certainly didn't want to step on any toes by launching into a full discussion if that's not appropriate.
Unless Mr. Smith correct me, I think we'd be fine to hear your arguments.
Right. I guess one question I might have, and is this fit within our request for reconsideration rule in terms of timelines and all that kind of stuff?
This is Jason Todd. I believe that it does. I don't have the rule in front of me right now, but I do recall that that we checked the time frame at the time that we filed and believed that we came within that. The commission order came out on November 17th of 2006. We read the commission rules as requiring a request for reconsideration to be filed within 30 days. And we filed this on December 15th of 2006.
Okay, well, that's what I had thought earlier when I looked at it when you first sent it in. I mean, I think with that, if the commission, I guess if they filed within the appropriate time, I would certainly assume that that the reconsideration is properly filed and on the table. And we don't normally make a motion or do that separately from hearing the thing on the merits, unless there's an objection to dates or whatever. That would usually be done here via affirmative motion or a motion from another party questioning whether your motion was timely filed. But other than that, I think you might as well proceed to what you want.
So that I, Commissioner Johnson here, so that I understand the process, we are going to be hearing Mr. Topp's arguments having to do with some merits of the case and asking the commission to open up a hearing to reconsider the commission's earlier decision.
That's right. That docket was marked closed, but under our rule they have a right within X period of time after the service of the order to file a motion. And, I haven't heard whether staff, whether you have an objection to timeliness or whatever. I mean, I'll also say this, that we've heard these things, the last time you were in here with this, it was, I've forgotten now your predecessor attorney,
Ms. Thompson?
Yeah, Ms. Thompson in here. She came at it a little different way, with a little different motion. But I think the important thing here is to hear what you want us to accomplish. I mean, it's really weird to have a party request reconsideration on an order approving.
Sure.
So to me, it's let's just move along to the merits. And in the end, I think it's going to get down to if you decide, if and when you decide to do something, it's going to be what, how to fashion a motion that gets to the relief you want, unless it's just been denied a motion.
If the commission were to decide to grant the request for reconsideration, I mean, then we're going to be having this back on another docket, though. I mean, wouldn't we be having a more a fuller hearing of the issues?
No, not as I understand it. As I understand it, if you grant what you're requesting, the relief you're requesting is that the that what we did at the earlier, a month ago, you want that reversed, and you want this commission, in response to your motion, to enter an order that would, in effect, or at least make a ruling that the agreement you filed need not be approved by the, and should not be approved by the commission at all. Is that right? That's what you're actually
asking for. Yeah, that is correct. This has to do with whether this agreement is appropriately considered an interconnection agreement, which requires commission approval under the Telecommunications Act. And we have had a practice for some time of, you know, where there is even a question as to whether something might be considered an interconnection agreement or not, to file those with the commission for their review, so that you can make a decision as to whether this is something you want to have filed as an interconnection agreement or not. And in this instance, it's our position that that this should not be considered an interconnection agreement. And so the relief that we are seeking is for the commission to determine that this particular agreement need not be filed, and therefore that the therefore reversing the commission's prior approval of the agreement.
So, Mr. Smith, aren't there really two questions before the commission? First is whether or not we would grant the request for reconsideration, and if the answer to that is yes, the commission could still decide either yes or no, perhaps today, perhaps at some later date, to agree with Quest's assertion.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. If you want to do it that way, that's fine with me. It doesn't make any difference to me. If that's the way you want to proceed.
Well, I don't...
It doesn't matter to me, but go
ahead. I mean, I'll look to advice as to what... I mean, the question, at least listed, is just, shall we grant the request for reconsideration? I mean, would there be a possibility that other parties would have an interest in how this question would be decided by the commission?
I don't know. Last time we did have interveners and so forth. If I think it's easily possible, I'll tell you this, that after hearing the arguments today, that you may not feel comfortable with deciding on the merits in any case. You know, I would have thought by now someone would have made some form of appearance in the matter if they had an interest, but because we've been around and around with this a few times here, and, you know, MCI is still right down the... or Midco, I mean, their attorneys are still five blocks away, and one would have thought they would have intervened like they did last time, but it doesn't bother me to go that way. What you're suggesting is grant the motion to reconsider and then schedule it for argument at a later date?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I offered up as a subject for discussion just because I wasn't here. I mean, I don't know how complex an issue this is. I mean, you know, if Mr. Topp has 3 or 4 minutes, I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. It may be possible that we're going to want to schedule 2 hours worth of oral arguments. Mm-hmm. But if you don't think that this is that kind of a proceeding, you think this is a 15-minute deal or an hour-long deal, we may be able to at least get all of the information we need today, even if we don't issue a, you know, bench decision.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I think we can do that today. I mean, my assumption was that the motion to reconsider was requesting, I mean, it requests substantive decision by the commission. And I think, my assumption is that's what we were going to hear about today.
And this is probably just a misunderstanding or probably misassumption on my part. I mean, I wonder if in the future then the agenda shouldn't say as a second question, and if so, shall the commission, you know, and then explain what the requested action,
granted,
what the petitioned action is.
grant the relief.
Because this, and I certainly don't mind hearing arguments today. I might throw out there that I think it would make sense for us to take this under advisement, if for no other reason than if somebody out there really has an interest in this, that that would give them another opportunity to make their interest and concern known to this commission, part of the commission issuing a decision.
Sure.
That is a very long answer to your short question, Mr. Todd.
Well, it was probably good to get it clarified, nonetheless.
Well, my apologies for delaying you. Unless Commissioner Hansen or Commissioner Kolbeck have anything else of an introductory nature, I would say we could probably look to you to make your argument, sir.
Okay.
Thanks. Go ahead. Proceed.
Thank you. Again, this is Jason Topp from Quest. On October, this filing arises from sort of a history of issues, as I alluded to earlier, in making sure that we're complying with our interconnection agreement filing requirements under Section 252 of the Act. We have, traditionally in our interconnection agreements had a unbundled network element platform product offering, which we were required to provide pursuant to FCC rules, and that was something that was included in interconnection agreements. After some FCC rulings removed portions of our obligation to provide unbundled switching to CLEX, we started entering into commercial agreements with CLEX for providing switching and associated transport to CLEX that they could combine with loops in order to provide the same services as were provided as UNIP, a portion of it is, or the loop is purchased pursuant to the interconnection agreement. The switching and transport has been purchased pursuant to the Quest Platform Plus agreement. We filed those with various state commissions in South Dakota in 2004 in the MCI Metro case, issued a ruling determining that the Quest Platform Plus agreement was, in fact, should be considered an interconnection agreement that should be filed. Various states have ruled in various ways on that issue. Since that time, we've reached a new agreement which is similar but designed to replace or update the Quest Platform Plus agreement. And we believe that it's different from the Quest Platform Plus agreement with respect to its relationship to the interconnection agreement, such that we believe that the commission should rule differently on that issue in this instance. And essentially what the what this agreement does is, once again, it provides the loop and switching and transport to CLEX. It does so at non-251 TELRIC pricing and contains the terms and conditions under which that would be priced. And in looking at the QPP agreement, the commission based its decision on a finding that the QPP agreement was integrated with the interconnection agreement to the point that they really should be treated as one and the same thing. The commission focused on the pricing provisions in that QPP agreement, and there were some provisions in there that had the pricing adjust if there were any pricing adjustments in the interconnection agreement. The commission listed three other factors in reaching its decision, one of which that was that an interconnection agreement amendment was entered into at the same time. There were mutual provisions in the QPP agreement and the interconnection agreement that provided for the triggering of termination of either agreement, and also certain rates in the QPP agreement were dependent upon implementation of certain processes in the interconnection agreement. We filed this local services platform agreement this year on October 11th and pointed out that each of those factors does not exist with this local services platform agreement, and asked the commission to make a decision or provided it for the commission's information so that if the commission held a different viewpoint as to whether this should properly be considered an interconnection agreement or not, the commission could let us know. On November 17th, the commission issued an order that, in the first instance, mischaracterized our filing of October 11th. The order indicated that we had filed this agreement for approval with the commission. That is something we did not do. There's an October 11th, 2006 cover letter in which I explain why we believe that this is an agreement that does not require commission approval. So that's one point that we're seeking, is we'd like to have that clarified, because sort of this dividing line is an issue that is out there, and we would prefer not to have a commission order indicating that we conceded something was an interconnection agreement when we did not do so. The second thing we would ask is that the commission reconsider its decision in approving the agreement as an interconnection agreement. We think that there are some significant differences, which I've highlighted in general for the commission, and certainly would be happy to go into more detail if the commission decides to delve further into the issue.
Thank you very much, Mr. Topp. At this time, we would look to staff to hear their thoughts and recommendations.
This is Kara Van Bakkern for staff. As Mr. Topp indicated in his cover letter and now in his request for reconsideration by the commission, he does argue four specific points to distinguish this agreement from the 04 agreement that the commission ruled on. The first was the fact that this agreement was not executed contemporaneously with the interconnection agreement. I don't see where that really matters at this point. If the commission finds that there are enough one agreement, they relate enough to each other, the actual execution date, I don't think, should be a decision-making point. The second, third, and fourth, the termination triggers the rate dependency of the two agreements, and the fourth being, again, a rate element interrelation. I think all three of those can be lumped together and create a broad argument that the two agreements were just so interrelated that they couldn't be separated. I can make that same argument for this agreement and the interconnection agreement. If you look to the service descriptions, none of the services provided in this Quest Local Service Platform Agreement could be provided if there wasn't currently an interconnection agreement. So although the rates of the two aren't connected, every other service is, even though the rates are not. So I argue, staff argues that the two agreements are connected and cannot be separated, that this should be before the commission for approval. Although I do agree that the order previously issued could be amended in some way to indicate that Quest does not believe it was properly before the commission for approval. I would concede that maybe we should amend that prior order to indicate that, but I still argue that it's connected enough in your connection agreement that it was properly before this commission for approval.
Thanks very much, Ms. Van Bakkeren. At this time, questions and comments by commissioners and advisors are appropriate. Go ahead. I do have one for either Mr. Topper and Ms. Van Bakkeren. I think it would be instructive to know how other state commissions have viewed this kind of a situation. Mr. Topp, do you have any insight on that?
Yes. With respect to the QPP agreement, as far as I'm aware, I know that Washington and South Dakota ruled that it was properly an interconnection agreement. I know that a number of other states have ruled that it need not be filed. With respect to the this particular local services platform agreement, no state has, to my knowledge, ruled that this particular agreement need be filed as an interconnection agreement, and hence our concern with the commission's ruling on this particular issue. I checked specifically into Washington because that was the commission decision that South Dakota relied most closely on when making its decision with respect to the QPP agreement, and Washington has not addressed the issue to this point. So while I can't cite for you any particular decisions, because often if the commissions have received it and you know, not opened a docket and not made, I don't think it's been a contested issue in any state, but we have not had a state which has taken the position that this local services platform agreement is in fact an interconnection agreement that needs to be filed and approved by a state commission.
Thanks very much. Mr. Smith, you had some questions, or at least a question.
Actually, that was one of the questions I had. So I noticed you guys had filed, I only checked Washington too, and you have filed this exact same agreement there, but I couldn't see where any staff position or anything else had occurred yet in those dockets.
That is correct, yeah. I don't believe that there has been any active proceedings, and I suppose I could argue to you that that means we're right in Washington, but I'm not sure of the reasoning behind that. I just know that they have not taken action to this point.
Well, and I think you cited in your letter or somewhere, maybe that was in the Washington letter you wrote, to the Verizon staff memorandum, which is in the Verizon case that involves what may or may not be a similar agreement. You know, the only problem we have with that is we can't look at the Verizon agreement because it was filed confidentially.
Right.
You know, I don't know. At some point here, it might not hurt to point out the similarities or dissimilarities of that, if you know.
I believe that those agreements are in material terms identical. I don't know that there's any difference whatsoever. I know that this is a standard agreement that we are offering to CLEX, and I'm not aware that there's any variation.
Well, my next question is, this is more of maybe a kind of an oddball procedural question, I guess, but, I mean, this is a very strange situation we're in here where we did something that you didn't request. You know, you know what I mean? I mean, we had, in effect, a... Yeah, we issued relief that you didn't in any way, manner, shape request from us. Is that true?
That is correct. You know, we've asked for your review as to whether this should be considered an interconnection agreement. You know, we've provided it for your information along with our analysis of the issue, but we did not request approval of it as an interconnection agreement.
And the only reason I bring that up is just to, I guess I'd like your thoughts on, you know, if you didn't, what did you request from us? A ruling? And again, I'd have to dig out your
report. Yeah, what
I have in my file, but.
Yeah, no, what the filing says is we assert that the agreement's not subject to filing and approval requirements of Section 252, but as part of the company's efforts to promote transparency of its decisions related to Section 252 issues, we are providing you with a copy of the agreement for your information along with the above analysis, which is basically our legal position with respect to the issue.
Did you have additional questions, Mr. Smith?
I might in just a second. I'm looking at the letter again here. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, and maybe I'm looking for a procedural out so I don't have to read this darn thing, but, you know, it's not like we didn't hammer you or anything for failing to file. This wasn't like an enforcement proceeding or anything from us. And I guess what I'm getting at is maybe, and again, I'm just looking at a way to analyze this here maybe legally, is if you didn't request approval of this agreement, I mean, is what we did earlier, is there like an ultra vires type of argument to be made there at all?
Well, I suppose that there is, but certainly we want to respect the commission's wishes with respect to filing interconnection agreements. And so, you know, if you tell us that this is an interconnection agreement, I fully expect that we would file. I can't promise whether there would be an appeal that would go along with that or not, but we would, making sure we comply with the filing requirements is so important to us that you know, if you direct us to file, that's what we will in fact do. The concern is, of course, when you're submitting agreements pursuant to Section 252, it's not so much the filing requirement as the potential that commissions may require arbitration or alteration of the terms of an agreement, which we think, you know, are not governed by the restrictions under Section 251 and 252. And so that becomes a real sensitive issue for the company quite quickly, irrespective of the practical impact of what the commission has done with regard to this particular agreement. It's certainly there's no harm to us by having the commission approve this agreement other than, you know, the potential of future actions down the road, this decision could impact.
Right, and I think we understand that. I guess what I'm going back, but in the original filing, I mean, you filed it as an agreement. You did not file it and seek commission approval of the agreement.
We did not. That is correct.
So I guess my point is, I mean, is that a way for, I mean, I'm not looking to get out of this, I guess, but, and here's maybe my point, and maybe just to be blunt about it, is if you elect to not, to give it to us for informational purposes and not to request any relief from us, and you're not requesting a declaratory ruling or anything, you know, I guess my point is that kind of, you know, on the one hand, it puts the burden, or I call it the risk, back on Quest, in terms of if you want to take that position, you know, it's your legal risk if it turns out at some later date the FCC or this commission or somebody else rules that it should have been filed, right?
That's correct.
And on the other hand, it puts the burden on us if you look at it that way, to do something affirmative by way of an enforcement action or whatever if we think it should be filed. Is that also a...
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we started doing this for informational purposes in the spirit of being open with commissions so that the commission can see the decisions we're making. We understand that this has been a hotly contested area of law in the past, and we don't want to run around and do something secret here. So it's certainly our preference that if the commission believes that this should be filed, that we want to know about it and be in a position to comply with those rulings. And so simply having, you know, accepting the filing and making no decision, I guess we could evaluate our risks one way or another on that front. But that does make it difficult for, you know, us on our end to, on one hand, preserve our legal rights, and on the other hand, be, you know, very transparent and open and straightforward with what we're doing out there in the marketplace.
Right. Okay. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's just all I'm trying to get at here is if we think there was never a pleading filed in this case, and we decided, in effect, we went ahead through whatever, inadvertence or whatever, and I don't think Quest said anything either when we took this up, and so we just might have forged ahead and granted a petition that was never made. And if we did that, you know, that, and that puts us back to where you guys did what you did. You gave us an informational filing, and we haven't approved it, and it's not a formal 252 filing.
Right.
So that's your risk at that point, because we haven't been asked to make any ruling on it at all. Is that
sure.
Is that what I'm hearing you say you want?
My guess is what we really want is a ruling that this is not, in fact, a 252 agreement. I think independent of that, a decision, you know, to accept the filing and vacate the prior ruling certainly eliminates the immediate problem. And then, you know, as to whether we feel like we would need to ask for something affirmative in order to have that issue resolved with respect to this agreement, that is something that we could go ahead and make a decision on once the commission came out with its order.
Thank you.
Ms. Van Bakker, did you have something to add?
Well, a suggestion from staff, I guess, would be that if, in fact, commissioners find that this agreement was not filed, it was never properly in front of the commission, an order should not have been issued, if we could get rid of that order that was issued in some correct procedural way. And if Quest would like to open a separate docket to seek commission order that this is not an interconnection agreement, that would maybe be a more appropriate way to handle this issue. And place the burden on Quest to request that docket for that. Because that, if they never filed anything regarding that particular issue, because they're claiming nothing was filed, how can commissioners make a decision on that at this time? That specifically being whether or not that agreement is an interconnection agreement.
I don't want to refer to it as a technicality, because I know it's bigger than that, but at some point, is it a decision on the merits? I mean, isn't it important to determine, is it an interconnection agreement or isn't it? As opposed to falling back on, well, it was never really filed, so we'll pretend it didn't happen.
I agree that that is an important decision to make. However, if staff would have read this letter very literally, it would never have been put on a it would never have been put on an agenda because it wasn't filed. It was simply information.
One wonders if more regulatory certainty isn't provided by the commission in making a yes or no determination, rather than sort of punting.
Yep. And that makes perfect sense, Commissioner. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Weiss, I couldn't help notice that you were staff assigned to the TC04-144 docket. Do you have anything to add?
At this point, I would think the commission would want to grant the request for reconsideration and then consider how to, you know, the decision at a later time. With respect to when the letter came in, I think once the letter came in and it was in our possession, at that point, if the commission or commission staff actually believed it was an interconnection agreement, then really the ball is kind of in our court to say it is an interconnection agreement. Quest, you do have to file it.
I don't know, but I think I agree with that. Any other commission or advisor questions or comments? I think I would offer up the motion to grant the request for reconsideration. I would also explicitly noted that this motion doesn't speak to the merits of Quest's argument at all, but that we would grant the request for reconsideration and then take the rest of the matter under advisement.
Second.
I concur.
Motion carries. Thanks very much for your time, Mr. Topp. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I believe at this time that concludes the business before the commission. A few announcements. The next regularly scheduled commission meeting will be held on January 23rd at 1:30, again in room 468 here at the State Capitol Building. Commission meetings are also scheduled for February 13th and March 13th. An ad hoc meeting regarding the Black Hills Power Rate case was held on December 28th at 9 a.m. The commission offices were closed on January 1st, yesterday, and the commission office will be closed on January 15th in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I would finally note that a legislative open house will be held in the commission offices on Tuesday, January 16th, 2007, from 7:30 a.m. to 11 a.m., and we'd certainly invite all legislators and other interested parties to attend that open house. Thank you very much, and at this time, the commission meeting is adjourned.